Sure. Tao, the Pathless Path, Volume 2. Talks and extracts from the Lita Zoo, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 13.
Duke Mu of Qin said to Polo, "You are getting on in years. Is there anyone in your family whom I can send to find me horses?" "A good horse can be identified by its shape and look, its bone and muscle. But the great horses of the world might be extinct, vanished, perished, lost. Such horses raise no dust and leave no tracks. All my sons have lesser talent. They can pick a good horse, but not a great one. But there is a man I know who carries and hauls and collects firewood for me, Chui Fang Kao. As a judge of horses, he is my equal. I suggest that you see him." Duke Mu saw the man and sent him away to find horses. After 3 months, he returned and reported to the Duke, "I have got one. It is in Shu Qiu." "What kind of horse?" "A mare, yellow." The Duke sent someone to fetch it. It turned out to be a stallion and black. The Duke, displeased, summoned Polo. "He's no good, that fellow you sent me to find horses. He cannot even tell one color from another, or a mare from a stallion. What can he know about horses?" Polo breathed a sigh of wonder. So now he has risen to this. It is just this that shows he is worth 1,000, 10,000, any number of people like me. What such a man as Cao observes is the innermost native impulse behind the horse's movements. He grasps the essence and forgets the dross, goes right inside it and forgets the outside. He looks for and sees what he needs to see, ignores what he does not need to see. In the judgment of horses, of a man like Cao, there is something more important than horses. When the horse arrived, it did prove to be a great horse.
Cao is the vision of the totus, the vision of the whole. Paths don't matter. Paths don't have any meaning in themselves. The meaning belongs to the whole, to the unity, to the organic unity. If you look for meaning in the paths, you will look in vain. Not only that, if you insist to look for the meaning in the past, you will destroy meaning rather than finding it. It will be a destructive attitude. For example, a poem does not exist in the words that constitute it. It exists somewhere beyond the words. It is transcendental. If you dissect the words, the sentences, the linguistic form, what you are going to gain? If you dissect a poem, if you dismember a poem, you are killing an alive unity, as if you are dissecting the body of a man. By the time you have succeeded in dissecting the body of the man, the spirit is gone. Whatsoever you will find will be dead corpse. And you were searching for the man, not for the dead corpse. And the man is in the unity, so is the poem. If you dismember a poetry, you will find sentences. If you dismember the sentences, you will find propositions. If you dismember the propositions, you will find words. If you dismember the words, then alphabet is left. But where is the poetry? The poetry that has thrilled your heart. Where is that beauty that has touched your being, that had given you wings? Where is that vision? In the alphabet, there is nothing. How it disappears? Your approach was basically wrong. Your approach was basically destructive violence. You dissected it. A poetry has to be seen in its totality. It has to be grasped as a whole. If you can grasp it as a whole, then each word contributes to it. If you cannot grasp it as a whole, then words don't constitute it. Words constitute only the body of a poem, not the heart of it. Yes, the heart cannot exist without the body, but the heart is not the body. The man cannot exist without the body, certainly so. But the man is not just the body. Man is far more. Man is far superior. Man is far higher. Tethered to the body, living in the body, but not the body itself. Body is the temple, and man is the god in it. Yes, if you destroy the temple, the god will not have any abode, will disappear, evaporate. So disappears a poem. The poem is the god that resides in the words, the rhythm, the meaning, the beauty. Listen, a small haiku of Basho, the greatest master of haikus. A very small, few words. The ancient pond. And when I say it, visualize it, because a haiku has to be visualized. It is a picture poem. In visualization only you will understand. The ancient pond. A frog jumps in. Plop. Finished. You can visualize it. You can visualize in your innermost eye the ancient pond with moss on the rocks. You can almost touch it. You can feel the texture of it. Very ancient pond. Dry leaves on the surface. Dry leaves on the banks. Old pine trees standing on guard. You can visualize it. You can smell the smell of the pine trees, the fragrance, the coolness, maybe the morning sun. The frog, you can see the frog alive. The frog jumps in. In fact, in Japanese, the actual translation will be a frog jump in, not jumps in. A frog jump in. Because the frog and the jump are not two things. You cannot dissect the frog from his jump. He is the jump. In the jump he is. So in Japanese and Chinese, the language is far more deep than any other language. But to put it rightly, in right English, we will say, a frog jumps in, as if he is doing something. To jump is not doing anything for a frog. It is not an act. It is spontaneous. A frog jump in, plop, the sounds, the ripples on the surface of the old lake, and silence. Now, if you dissect this small poem, only 13 syllables in it. What you are going to get? You will get few words. Then dissect the words and you get alphabet, linguistic elements. All meaning is lost. It is as if you go and see a beautiful painting and you dissect it into its colors. The painting is lost. I give you a beautiful lotus flower and you dissect it into its chemical constituents. Then the lotus is lost. That's how science has destroyed all meaning in life. If in the West people are feeling life is meaningless, it is a byproduct of their scientific endeavor. Science was trying to make life more intelligible. It has made life more intelligible, but all meaning is lost. Far happier were those people who had not much knowledge about life. Life had more meaning then. They had not dissected the lotus. They were enjoying the lotus. They were not worried about the constituents, what chemicals. They were not worried what beauty is. They were enjoying it. They were in it. They were swallowing it. They were swallowed by it. They were in tune with beauty, life, existence, and there was meaning. Now, science has made things much more intelligible. It has explained almost everything, and through explanations, the whole beauty is destroyed. Explanation is in your hand, but where is the mystery of life? If you go to a biologist and ask him what is love, he will explain it to you. It is nothing but a hormonal thing. Some chemicals running in your veins, in your arteries, in your blood. Some hormones released by your glands. That's what love is. Now tell to a mother that the love that you have for your child is nothing but hormonal. Tell to a woman who has fallen in love with a man and is ready to sacrifice her whole life, is ready to die, will be happy to die for this man. Tell her that it is just hormonal. And you are not saying something wrong. You are perfectly true. You are perfectly right. But something is missing in your truth. Your truth is dead. Your truth is concerned with the lowest denominator. As if somebody asks you about the lotus and you say nothing but the mud. What is a lotus? Nothing but the mud, because it comes out of the mud. What is love? Hormonal, because it comes out of hormones. That's why Freud reduced all love to sexuality. And then prayer also, then God too. Everything became sexual. The moment prayer, love and God all become sexual, something is missed. Tao's approach is just the opposite. Tao says rather than explaining a thing by the part, rather than explaining the whole by the part, try to explain the part by the whole. For example, this haiku I told you, the ancient ponds. A frog jump in, plop. Now, the frog word, or the word plop, the sound plop, can exist in 1001 contexts. In every context, it will have a different meaning. Because the meaning will depend on the context. Plop itself does not carry the meaning. It depends. In the Basso's haiku, you suddenly know what it is. Because the frog, The frog gives meaning to it. The ancient pond gives meaning to it. In a different context, it will mean a different thing. The context gives the meaning. The whole gives meaning to the parts. The ancient pond. Now the word ancient can be used in 1001 ways. You will find it used in many ways. In every context, it will have a different meaning. So meaning is not contained in the word ancient. The meaning is contained in the whole in which the word is used. And you can see it in your whole life. Everything has meaning only because it is part of an organic unity which is higher than it, bigger than it. The meaning comes from the high. The meaning comes from the bigger. The meaning certainly comes to the lowest, but the lowest is not the determining factor. Look at the different approach. If you ask the scientist, he will say the lotus is nothing but the mud. If you ask the Taoist, he will say the mud is nothing but lotus. Now, the difference is tremendous. When you say lotus is nothing but the mud, the dirty mud, you have destroyed all beauty. Then only dirty mud is left in your hands and in your souls. Then you are left with a filthy life. Taoists say, if a lotus can come out of the mud, then the mud cannot be just mud. It must be carrying the lotus, the possibility of the lotus, the fragrance, the color, the beauty of the lotus must be hidden somewhere in the mud. So don't call it just mud. It carries the lotus. It is the womb for the lotus. So even mud becomes beautiful. And you start looking for the meaning in the mud. And it is there somewhere. You may be able to see, you may not be able to see. That depends on your clarity, your eyes. But condemnation disappears. Freud says, all love is nothing but sex. Even the love of God. Even the love of Mira to Krishna. And the love of Anand to Buddha. And the love of Mary Magdalene to Jesus is nothing but sexuality. Can't you see how much beauty is desired immediately in one stroke? If you ask the Taoist, he will say, even when a man goes to make love to a prostitute, there is something of the prayer in it. There is something of divine in it. Just 2 days before, I saw an article written by Dutta Bal, and he has put me with Freud. As if we both say the same thing. Now there cannot be any more much misunderstanding. I say, sex is love. Freud says love is sex. And the difference is tremendous. I say in sex also there is a glimpse of samadhi. I make sex also sacred. Freud says in samadhi, in Ramakrishna samadhi, there is nothing but repressed sexuality. He makes samadhi also profane. Now those who have no understanding, they can put me in one bracket with Freud. It is very easy. Simple. They will say, what is the difference? Whether you call love sex or you call sex love. There is no difference, not much, if you only think of the words. Then there is only this much difference that I put sex in one place and love in another, and Freud puts them just in the opposite places. So not much difference. But can't you see the difference? The difference is tremendous, vital, and of great value. And much will depend on that difference. The Taoist vision is to look at the part through the whole, so that the whole can give a meaning to the part, can make it meaningful, not otherwise. Your eyes are beautiful. Taken out of your body, they will not be. It happened in the life of Vincent van Gogh. He was an ugly man, very ugly. A great painter and a beautiful soul, but a very ugly body. No woman ever fell in love with him. He was repulsive. He was a horrible. And he suffered very much. At the age of 33, he committed suicide. If there is nobody to love you, for what to live? Once visiting a prostitute, he said, nobody has ever said anything to me lovingly. Nobody has said that you are beautiful, or you are nice, or you are this or that. I hanker for it. The woman took pity on him. Must have had a very compassionate heart. She looked to find something so she can appreciate, but she could not find. The face was ugly, the nose was ugly, the eyes were ugly, and everything was topsy-turvy. Just the ears. So she said, but you have beautiful ears. And she played with his ears. He went home, cut his ears, and presented to the woman. She could not believe. The blood was flowing. And he had brought the ear, and he said, you liked it, so now it belongs to you. But an ear cut out of the body is no more beautiful. Even the most beautiful ear will become ugly. Take things out of their context and they lose all meaning. They lose all beauty. They lose all truth. Truth is with the whole, so is beauty, so is goodness. This is the first thing to be understood about Tao. It is a vision of the whole. And the whole has not to be put together, the second thing to remember. For example, there have been people who try to put the whole together. For example, Freud psychoanalysis tried to dissect human mind, human psyche into fragments. That's why it is called analysis, psychoanalysis. First he dissected the human mind into its constituent parts and discarded much. Then came Acciaiuoli and he created psychosynthesis. What Freud has done, Acciaiuoli tries to undo it. He puts parts together again. Now Freud has discarded and Acciaiuoli has not been able to revive, cannot. Will be difficult, but has to be understood. That will help you to understand the Taoist attitudes. Freud is doing analysis. First he cuts the limbs of a body, he spreads all the limbs on the table, examines them, and then comes Acciaiuoli. He puts all the limbs together again, binds them together, glues them together, and thinks now the man is whole. Both are wrong. Once you have killed something, you cannot put it together. Life is so precious. Once gone, it goes forever. You cannot put it together. If somebody takes all the petals of the rose apart and then comes a Segoli and puts all the petals together, pins them together and says, now it is the real flower. No, it is not the real flower. It only gives a false idea of unity, but the unity is not there, because the pins that are holding it were no more, never part of it, and the glue that is holding it was never a part of an alive rose. The alive rose was holding itself together, remember it. It was not being held together by something else. It was not dependent for its unity on something. It was holding itself together. That was the spirit that keeps together, that holds you together. It is not that your hand and your legs and your eyes are put together. No. Something in you exists which is keeping them together. Once the unity is destroyed, you can put things back. It will be a false unity. So I am not in favor of Freud analysis. I am neither in favor of a Segoli synthesis. My attitude is exactly that of Tao. What Tao says? Tao says, look for the unity that existed before analysis began. Go to the primordial, the primitive unity, the original. Go to the original. Synthesis comes after analysis. It follows analysis. It succeeds analysis. And the wholeness precedes analysis. It is before analysis has destroyed. The vision has to be total. And you have to see things in their totality. You are not to put them together. If you put them together, it will be a false unity. It will be a synthetical synthesis. It will be artificial, plastic. It will not be true. Is it clear to you? You look at the tree is together. You look deep into the tree is together with the earth, because it is joined together. If you look deeply, the earth is together with the sun. Without the sun, the earth cannot exist. Without the sun, the tree will not be green and will not be alive. Without the air surrounding it, it will not be able to breathe. So it is joined together with the air, with the earth, with the sun, and with the stars. With everything. The whole existence is intertwined with each other. I am in you, you are in me, we are in the trees are in us, and we are in the earth, and the earth is in us, and we are intertwined. Members of each other, we are. We don't exist as separate. To look from this high standpoint of ultimate unity is what Tao is. And then things have a totally different color. Then your vision reveals you things which cannot be revealed on lower planes. It is not a question of putting them together. One day, a Christian missionary came to me and he said, I am happy that you are trying to put all the religions together. I said, you have not understood me. I am not putting them together. I see them as one. I am not putting them together. I am not making a synthesis. I am not in agreement with Mahatma Gandhi, who was trying to create a synthesis, putting together Islam, Hinduism, Christianity, few parts from the Bible and few from the Quran and few from the Gita, and making something out of it, a hodgepodge, a tiddly. It is not unity. It is not the total vision. I am not putting Christ and Muhammad and Mahavir and Krishna and Lao Tzu together. No, I see them, they are one. It is not a question of putting them together. I am not making any effort to put them together. I am not trying to find some synthesis in them. They are one. That is my experience. They are one. They have never been separate. The separation is not possible. They join together into truth. They know the same truth. They live the same life. They enjoy the same bliss. Their samadhi is one. I am not putting anything together. I am simply saying it is so. Second thing, Tao is not interested in understanding anything in separation, because that understanding will be false, rooted in falsity. You cannot understand the thing separately, because in that very separation, in that very definition, you have taken it out of its total context, out of its organic unity. Then you may have an explanation but no understanding. Science explains, religion understands. Explanations are concerned with the parts, understanding is concerned with the total. Understanding is a very vague thing, liquid, cloudy. Explanation is very clear cut. Because it is clear cut, that's why it is wrong. Because in life there is nothing clear cut. Boundaries merge and meet. For example, you see a woman. In the morning she will be a woman, in the evening she may become a man. You see a man, he is very angry. And within a moment she will become soft and may become a woman. It happened last night. I hit hard on Yatri's head. And he shouted and he screamed. And he said, I will cut your head, Bhagwan. And I know him, he is a very feminine person. But he became very, very aggressive. And then he cooled down. And fell in my feet. Now what to do? Rather than cutting my head, he fell in my feet. Now this is not the same person who was going to cut my head, puts his head in my feet. And the interval is not very big, within few minutes. In that moment he was male, young. Then he became female, in. Boundaries meet and merge. The person who loves you can be angry. The person who is angry can love you. In reality, nothing is very clear cut. And it is good that it is not very clear cut. Look, higher the being, more vagueness. Lower the being, more clear cutness. A rock has far more clear-cut definitions than a man. The rock remains the rock. You go in the morning, you go in the evening, you go in the night. The rock remains the rock. But the man goes on changing, changing, changing. Higher the unity, more delicate the balance. Lower the unity, more fixed the balance. When a person is really attained to the ultimate, he is very Phillips, river-like. He is no more like an ice cube. He has melted. An ice cube has definite boundaries. An ice cube can be defined. But when you have melted, all definitions disappear. Tao does not give any explanation, but it understands. Science gives explanations, but it doesn't understand. And the very explanations become barriers to understanding. The moment you have explained a thing, you have disguised its mystery. Never say that something is completely explained. That means it is completely meaningless. Explain a thing and you have explained it away. When the husband says that I understand my wife totally, love has disappeared. Now love cannot exist. Love can exist only when still there is mystery. The husband yet does not understand. The wife yet does not understand. Yet there is a possibility that the husband may do something and the wife will be surprised. The surprise is still possible. That means everything is not explained. Something remains unexplained. Something remains elusive. Something remains mercury-like. You go on grasping it and it remains slipping out. That's the beauty of life. Tao says the whole life is mercury-like. The total is so alive. No fixed explanations are possible. You cannot label anything. Things change so fast. By the time you have labeled, your label is already false. The thing has changed. By the moment you have said something, the utterance is already meaningless. Because the reality is no more the same. Explanations Tao has none. Understanding it has tremendous. And this is one of the basic ingredients of understanding that life is a mystery. The third thing, science tries to explain things by their causes, and Tao tries to understand things by their ends. The difference is of tremendous value, has to be understood. Science goes into the causes, the how of things. Tao goes into the end, the ultimate flowering, the why of things. For example, if you fall in love with a woman or a man, science will ask how. How you fell in love. It will go into the causes of it. Tao will ask why. It will go into the end of it. Science moves towards the seeds for its explanation, and Tao moves towards the flower or the fruit for its understanding. Science goes into the past, Tao goes into the future. Science looks into the dead, Tao looks into the possibility and the potentiality. It is said about a Sufi mystic. He was sent to India by a great Iranian king as a messenger to the Indian emperor. There was some conflict and the Iranian emperor was a little worried. And he sent this Sufi mystic to make things, put them right, create some understanding between the two countries. The mystic came to the emperor, to the Indian emperor, and presenting his credentials, he appreciated the Indian emperor very much, and he said, "You are a full moon." Now, the news reached Iran that he has said to the king, "You are a full moon." And when he was departing from Iran, he had said to the Iranian king that, "You are a new moon." The Iranian king was very much angry. New moon means just the beginning. The first day moon, you cannot even see it. Only second day, it becomes a little visible. On the third day, a little more. And he has said to the Indian emperor that, "You are the full moon." This is insulting. "Let him come." The emperor was waiting in anger. Came back the mystic, and he was caught hold immediately. Brought to the court and asked for explanation. He laughed. He said, "It is simple. A full moon is finished. It is already dead. A full moon is on the deathbed. It is ready to decline. It has a past but no future. Hence I said," the Indian king, "you are a full moon. To you I have called the first day moon, the new moon. You have future. You have potentiality. You are growing. Maybe his empire is big, but it is dead. Look, when something has a past, it is already old. Science goes into the past. That's why if you go to the psychoanalyst, he will go into your past. He will say, relate your whole past. What happened in the past? From your very childhood, go on from there." He goes into the past. If a man is mad and is brought to a psychoanalyst, the psychoanalyst goes into the cause. Why? In the first place he became mad. He has to go there. He has to look into the past, find out the cause there. If you are brought to a Taoist, he will not go into the past. He will look into your future. He will think to what purpose your madness can be used. Just look the approach to what purpose your madness can be used. If you are mad, can your madness be put to dancing, to meditation, to singing? Certainly a madman has more energy available. Maybe that's why he is mad. Now his madness can be used in a creative way. There is no need to think how to destroy it. The need is how to use it, how to be creative about it. If you go to a Taoist, he will look into your madness, he will try to figure out your future, your higher possibilities, and he will try how to use your madness for that future, how to make your madness serve your destiny. That's what I'm doing here. When you come to me, you are mad, you are neurotic, I'm not worried about it. My whole function here is how to make it creative. Madness is great energy. If you look in the past, it is a problem. If you look in the future, it can be used and can become a stepping stone. Everything can be used. Tao believes exactly in the same way a gardener uses the manure. You can hold manure and it will simply stink and it will make your life impossible. But you can spread the manure in the bags, flower bags, and the same stinking manure will become tremendously valuable perfume in the flowers. It has been used rightly. A manure is not to be collected. it has to be spread in flower beds. Then flowers come bigger, with more colors, with more life, with more fragrance, with more stability, with more zest and enthusiasm. And it is the same manure that may have become a stinking and may have made life impossible. What is madness? It is manure. What is anger? What is hatred? What is jealousy? It is manure. If you go on hoarding it, you will go mad. Certainly. It will be impossible to live with it. The Taoist approach is to spread it on the flower beds. It can serve meditation. It can serve love. It can serve joy. It can serve happiness. It can serve God. A madman can reach God faster than the so-called sane people, because the sane people move very cautiously. They don't run. They don't rush. The sane people move only so far and always think, doubt, hesitate, linger, wait, and they have many, many things that hold them back. A madman simply rushes. Nothing holds him. He is certainly mad. There is nothing to hold him. If he wants to do something, he will do it. If a madman becomes interested in God, then it is sure he is going to attain. If a madman becomes a painter, his painting will have a quality no sane person can ever paint that way. Because he will not only paint, he will put his whole life into it. Van Gogh was a madman, so was Picasso. In fact, all the great painters were mad people, and all the great poets were mad people. In fact, all the great people that have existed on the earth were thought someday or other by someone or other as mad. Madness has tremendous potentiality. Everything is potential. Look how it can be used. Look at the future. Never think in terms of being a full moon. Remain always a new moon. So, Tao approach is never for the cause but for the end. It is eschatological. It is not causal. And it is tremendously beautiful, because God is the end of the whole existence. That is the ultimate, where we are moving, to where we are going. That's what we are going to be. Everything can be put in a right way so that we can reach to that goal more easily, more softly, more joyously. The last thing before we enter into the parable. Philosophy divides knowledge into the subject and the object. With the object, you cannot have any dialogue. A rock is an object. You cannot have any dialogue. You can watch, you can dissect, you can observe, you can find few clues about it, but you cannot have any dialogue, because you don't believe that the rock is a person. It is an object. The word object is beautiful. It means objectum, which stands in your way. It prevents you from moving, which hinders your path. Object means which stands in the way like a barrier, like a wall. If you believe that the whole world is objective, as science believes, then the whole world is a China wall. There is no dialogue possible. If you look at your wife as an object to be used sexually or financially or in some other way, if you look at your husband as an object, a security or something like that, somebody to lean upon, somebody you can use, somebody you can depend upon, but as an object, then there is no dialogue. With being a husband and a wife, the dialogue never happens because both think the other as an object, as a means. They don't think the other as a person. Tao says everything is subjective. Even that which stands in your way has its own subjectivity. You can even provoke a dialogue with a rock. You can provoke a dialogue with a tree. What to say about human beings? You can provoke a dialogue with anything, with the universe itself, with the sky, with the wind. And then there is a relationship. You relate. When you think about things as things and not as persons, when you think about the world as objective, as science teaches you to do it that way, then you can hammer out few facts, but truth remains unrevealed. Truth is revealed only when you persuade existence, when you seduce existence through deep love, sympathy, when you are enwrapped with existence, when you touch the rock as you would like to touch a person, you feel the texture of it, you close your eyes, you create a sort of relationship with it. And if you are ready and if you understand Tao, you will be able to create a relationship with the rock. It will start talking to you sooner or later. It will respond. Because the whole existence is full of gods. There is nothing that is dead. Cannot be. How anything can be dead? All is alive, thriving, throbbing. Listen silently and you will feel the heart beat everywhere in the rock too. And then a dialogue is possible. In the old Indian scriptures it is said that the great science of Ayurveda was found not by objective research but by subjective dialogue. The Ayurvedic physicians will go to the trees, meditate with the trees, sit silently with the trees, and when they will fall and enwrapped with the being of the tree, they will ask, "Sir or Madam, whatever the case may be, would you like to say something to us? I am in search for a particular disease. I am searching for a medicine. Can you say your leaves can be of any help? Are your fruit, are your roots, are your bark? Are to what use? How can you help humanity? In what way?" And it is said, it is a beautiful story, that that is how Ayurvedic herbal medicines were discovered. Not by objective research, not by dissecting a tree, not by chemical analysis, but by dialogue. And so is said about Yunani medicine. The greatest Yunani physician, Lukman, did the same. He went to herbs. He will put his ear to the roots of a tree and listen silently and will fall in deep repose, will become thoughtless. will be silently there, will listen to the heartbeat of the tree. And when the right moment is there and the tree is ready to reveal its secret, he will take the secrets. And now it seems that the stories cannot be just stories, because they had no instruments really to find out. Instruments have not been found at all. And whatsoever they have said about trees has been found true. So the story seems to be literally true. Just one man, Lukman, has talked about 500,000 herbs. And there was no way, because no lab existed for such chemical analysis. And just one man, how he could find? The way was not analysis. The way was not synthesis. The way was not mind. The way was through the heart. A dialogue. When you are in dialogue, the tree becomes a Tao. You are I, the tree is the Tao. And there is a possibility. Explore this possibility. It will take time, because your mind has been too much conditioned by the object. It will take time, but it happens. You can grow this sensibility, and when this sensibility is grown, you have become a Taoist. No object is just an object. Every object is full of subjectivity, because every object has a soul to it. Nothing is soulless. As you are full of soul, interiority, so is everything else. Now, this tremendously beautiful parable. Duke Mu of Qin said to Po Lo, "You are getting on in years. Is there anyone in your family whom I can send to find me horses?" Now, horses in the ancient world were very important. Just as nowadays fighter planes are. The horse was the very hub of the war. And that was the fastest vehicles. Horses were valued very much. That was the only power. That's why still we go and say that the car is a 5 horsepower. That was the only power once. That was the only measurement. Still we go and say how much power this machine has. 5 horsepower, 10 horsepower. The measurement has still remained, at least in the language. The horses have disappeared by and by. They are no more needed. Their old utility is gone. But in those days, the people who could find a great horse were great masters. They were respected. Emperors will keep them, will pay them, will revere them. Because everything depended on a great horse. And a great horse, we don't know what they mean by a great horse, because that language has become almost useless for us. Horse is just an animal to us. It was not so. And horse is a very intelligent animal. And sometimes the intelligence of the horse can be of tremendous value to the king. He can save life. This man Po Lo must have been an expert, a master expert, about knowing what horse is good, what horse is bad, and what horse is really great. A good horse can be identified by its shape and look. its bone and muscles. But the great horses of the world might be extinct, vanished, perished, lost. Such horses raise no dust and leave no tracks. All my sons have lesser talents. They can pick a good horse, but not a great one. But there is a man I know who carries and hauls and collects firewood for me, Chiu Fang Cao. As a judge of horses, he is my equal. I suggest that you see him. This man, Polo, has become very old. Now he cannot go in search of the horses. The Duke asked him, can he suggest somebody else? First, his definition. A good horse can be identified by its shape and look, by its characteristics. Because a good horse is a trained horse. Training never goes deep, it remains on the surface. A man of character is like a good horse. A moral man is like a good horse. He has been cultivated. He has been well brought up, conditioned rightly, for right values. Wrong values have been repressed. Right values have been superimposed. A good horse has a character like a good man. But it is not a great horse. Then what is a great horse? A great horse is one who has intrinsic qualities, not imposed from the outside. A great horse is one who has inborn potentialities, not trained. A great horse is a natural power, is a born power. A good horse is a talented horse. A great horse is a genius. Somebody went to Mozart, the great composer and musician, and asked him, that I would like to learn music and I would like to become as great a musician as you are. How should I start? The man was very young, not more than 20 years of age. Mozart said, you seek a master. But the young man said, I have heard that you never learned from any master. So why should I seek? And I have heard that when you were just a kid of 7 years, you started composing great music. I'm 20. Why should I go to a master? Moses said, then it is up to you. But when I was seven, even when I was seven, I never went to ask anybody what to do about it. I did it. You have come to ask me. That simply shows, at the most you can have talents, you don't have the genius. Talents have to be learned. A talented man is imitative. He is imitating the genius. The genius is non-imitative, the genius is original. A good horse is a horse who has been trained to look like a great horse. He has no soul of the great horse, just the character. That's how it is in human life. A good man is a man who has been cultivated to look like a great man. A Christian saint is a good horse. Jesus is a great horse. The Christian saint has simply cultivated his character to look like Jesus. He is a carbon copy. So is a Buddhist monk, a good horse. Certainly good. And it is better to be good than to be bad. I am not against the good. Relatively, it is good. It is good to be a saint than to be a criminal. but nothing compared to the sage, nothing compared to a Buddha. A Buddha has not imitated anybody. It is his original face, uncultivated. It is how he is. Then what is the difference if somebody can cultivate a Buddha and become a Buddha by cultivation? Why we should be against him? In ordinary situations he will be able to pretend, but in extraordinary situations he will not be able to pretend. In ordinary situations he will look like a Buddha, but whenever there will be extraordinary pressure he will give in. That is the difference between a good horse and a great horse. A good horse will look, pretend, jump, show that he is a great horse. But when the right moment comes, when the danger arises, when there is a challenge, he will give in. The carbon copy cannot go very far. The original is needed. Only the original can be depended upon. One can trust only the original. When you are seeking a master, always seek an original man. Don't seek a cultivated man. It is difficult to live with an original man. That is certainly true. It is very difficult because it is difficult to grow. And with an original man, growth happens. It is very easy to be with an imitator. You must have read Thomas Kempis' very well-known book, Imitation of Christ. Now that can create only a good heart. You can look almost like Christ, but you cannot be Christ. The only way to be Christ is to be yourself. Buddha is a Christ. Christ is a Buddha. Buddhist monk trying to be a Buddha is not Buddha. And Jesus never tried to be a Buddha and he was a Buddha. When you are yourself, true to your being, you are a great soul. Whatsoever you are. If you just are a wood chopper, nothing to be worried, but be an original wood chopper. Be a real carpenter. That will do. You will attain to Buddhahood through there. That will be your door. There is no need to become a great poet. You can be a cook, but be original. Imitation is the greatest calamity. The old man said, a good horse can be identified by its shape and look, its bone and muscle. But the great horses of the world might be extinct. Vanished, perished, lost. Such horses raise no dust and leave no tracks. Look at the beauty of this sentence. These parables are not just stories. They have great insight. Such horses raise no dust and leave no tracks. A great horse is one who has no past and no future, who lives in the moment. That is the meaning of the sentence. Such horses raise no dust. When a great horse is coming, you will not be able to see that he is coming, because he will not raise any dust. You will not see a cloud of dust being raised. When he has come exactly in front of you, only then you will be able to see. But then it is too late. Then you cannot make arrangements. And the great horse leaves no tracks. You cannot follow a great horse. He leaves no tracks. No footprints are left. This is the quality of a Buddha, of a Christ. This is the quality of the great man. He is in the presence. He is unpredictable. You cannot say what he is going to do, or say, or be. Nobody knows. He is always a surprise. And he leaves no track behind. He is like a bird flying in the sky. The bird flies, no track. No trace is left behind, no footprints. Now there are books. One book, very famous, The Footprints of Buddha. The title is ugly, because the Buddha leaves no footprints. There are many books like that, which show misunderstanding. Buddha leaves no footprints. He walks so carefully and so alert. He leaves no footprints. You cannot follow him. He leaves no signs, indications, no maps. Otherwise, you will become imitators. There is a story of a great Zen monk, Bokoju. When he was dying, he called his disciples to bring all his books and all that he has said and all that he has written. Everything was piled up, they couldn't see what he was doing, and then he made a fire out of it. And they were screaming and shrieking, and they said, "What are you doing?" Because in those days there was no printing presses. They were handwritten books, last forever. But he said, "I'm going and I want to leave no trace behind. I should not leave any footprints." Now, whosoever wants to follow me will have to follow himself. Whosoever wants to understand me will have to understand himself. I am throwing you, all my disciples, to yourself. That's why I am destroying these. Another story of a Zen monk, dying on the deathbed, he called his chief disciple, took out a book from his underneath his pillow, and everybody was always curious about the book because he had never allowed anybody to see it. And in the night, people have sometimes peeped from the keyhole. He was reading it. "What book is that? And why he protects it so much? And he will never leave his room unlocked. He will lock it and he will never allow anybody to enter in his room alone." So nobody had really seen what the book contains. Then he called his chief disciple and said, "Keep this book. In this book there is everything that I have taught. Preserve it as you have known me preserve it. This was given from my master to me. Now I give it to you. It is a heritage." And the disciple threw the book into the fire. All others could not believe, they were aghast. But the master puts his hand on the head of the disciple and blesses him. And he said, "You have understood. If you had preserved the book, you were not my disciple at all. In fact, there was nothing in the book. It was empty. You have thrown it, good, you have understood. You have understood my teaching that nobody is to follow anybody. Everybody has to go into his own soul. Such horses raise no dust and leave no tracks. All my sons have lesser talents. They can pick a good horse, but not a great one." So he said, "I suggest a man, Qiu Fang Gao. He is a judge of horses as competent as myself, equal to me. Duke Nu saw the man and sent him away to find horses. After 3 months he returned. and reported to the Duke, "I have got one. It is in Satyu." What kind of horse? A mare. Yellow. The Duke sent someone to fetch it. It turned out to be a stallion in black. Now this is absurd. The man cannot be a judge of horses at all. He cannot even judge whether it is a stallion or a mare. Not only that, he cannot even judge whether it is black or yellow. This man is a blind man. He does not know anything about horses. These are simple things anybody knows. No master is needed to judge a horse whether it is yellow or black. Naturally, the Duke was very displeased. Summoned Polo. "He is no good, the fellow you sent to find me horses. He cannot even tell one color from another, or a mare from a stallion. What can he know about horses?" Now, something has to be understood. This is the Taoist approach about things. A mare means feminine. A mare means in quality. The Duke could not understand the man. The man is not talking about the body. The man is talking about the soul. The man is talking about the whole. The whole quality of the heart is that of in. Passive, receptive, womb-like. The whole quality of the heart is round, shapely, soft, with no corners. The whole quality of the heart is that of a beautiful woman. Non-aggressive, non-violent, loving, compassionate. That's what he's saying when he says that the heart is a mare. He is not talking about the body. He is not talking about the physical. He is not talking about the part, he is talking about the whole, the totality of the heart is feminine. Have you not watched it many times? You see a man and he looks very feminine. And sometimes you see a woman and she looks very masculine. Qualities. A Buddha is so feminine. A Buddha is a mare, not a stallion. That's how Nietzsche has criticized him, calling him feminine. Nietzsche has criticized Jesus also, calling him feminine. He has criticized these two men. They have destroyed the whole masculinity of the world, the manliness. His criticism is true in a way. These two persons brought the feminine into the world, the feminine grace. That's why you will never see mustache on Buddha's statue. Not that he had not. But those who know the quality of great horses, they know how to paint a Buddha. The body has not to be painted. The innermost core has to come out. Have you not watched? Mahavir has no mustache, no beard. Rama has no mustache, no beard. Krishna has no mustache, no beard. Buddha has no mustache, no beard. All the great sages of India, all the Tirthankaras, Avataras have no beard and no mustache. Do you think there was something hormonally wrong with them? They were effeminate, you think? They were sexually missing something? They were not man enough, you think? No. They were great sages. They had beards, they had mustaches. But the people who painted them knew the qualities of a great horse. It has to be looked in its totality. In that way, Jesus is not so fortunate. He could not find a real painter. If he had been born in India, he would have been no. He would have been without mustache and beard. The people who painted Jesus must have looked from the outside. They could not see the inner quality of the feminine. By saying that the heart is a mirror, this man, Qiu Fang Cao, has said something of tremendous value. The heart is non-aggressive. And Taoists say, when a person is non-aggressive, it is unconquerable. When a person is aggressive, he can be conquered. Because a person who is aggressive depends on his own energy. All energies are limited. And when a person is aggressive, he is wasting his energy in aggression. Sooner or later, he will be weakened by his own aggression. He will be defeated. How Adolf Hitler was defeated? He was too aggressive. That became his defeat. Don't you see, all the great aggressive people are always defeated eventually. What happens? They exhaust their energies themselves. Adolf Hitler or Mussolini or Napoleon or Alexander all die frustrated, failures. What happens to them? They exhaust their energy by fighting, by being aggressive. A Buddha dies a conqueror. Without fighting, he conquers. A Laos is victorious. Without making any efforts, his victory is ultimate. The great heart has the quality of non-aggressiveness. Nobody can defeat him. That is the meaning of a mare. And the color yellow is also very symbolic. It stands for a few things. First, yellow is the color of gold, the costliest. So, gold has always been used as the highest value. Gold became an alchemical symbol. Turning baser metal into gold means turning the lower into higher, turning the devil into divine, turning the grass into the subtle. When he says that the heart has the color yellow, he means he is a gold, not a baser metal. He is not talking about the color of the body. That is irrelevant. What color can make any difference? Whether the heart is black or white or yellow. The color of the body cannot make any difference. How the color can make a heart great or not great? Whether a person is a Negro, Indian, Chinese or American, black, white, yellow, how does it matter? The color of the skin is just irrelevant to the being. It is just a very cheap pigment. If you ask the scientist, he will say, between the Negro, the blackest Negro, and the whitest white man, the difference is only near about 4 annas worth pigment. Nothing much. Just a certain pigment exists in the Negro, which does not exist in the white man. So in fact, the white man is missing something. The Negro has something more. The Negro needs the black pigment to protect him from the sun, from the heat. Naturally, he is more powerful. He can tolerate more heat and remain cool. He need not go to the hill station. Wherever he is cool. The white man is in trouble. He cannot tolerate heat. His tolerance is very low. His body is not so resistant. But nothing much of a difference. And how this difference is going to make any difference as far as greatness is concerned? Whether Jesus is a Negro or a white man, how does it make any difference? It is irrelevant. That's why the old man has not talked about the body color. He is using the alchemical symbol gold. It is the highest quality, the purest quality. Second, the yellow is symbolic of the sun, vitality, radiance, aliveness, youth, life. So he is saying the great heart is very much alive, as yellow as the sun, as vital as the sun. And thirdly, the yellow is the color of death. That's why Buddha has chosen yellow as the color for his bhikkhus, for his bhikkhus and their robes, yellow. Why? Why the color of death? When a leaf dies, it becomes yellow. When anything dies, it becomes yellow. Yellow is death approaching close by. Yellow is the shadow of death. But why this heart should be told to the Duke that is yellow? Because only if somebody accepts death totally, then he is fearless. Otherwise not. The Buddhist monk has accepted death, has accepted yellow, the color of death, with great gratitude, with reverence. He is ready to die any moment. Hence there is no fear. All fear is of death. Behind all your fears is death. Sooner or later you go on finding, you will find death is standing behind all fears. So unless one is completely in deep acceptance with death, in harmony with death, one cannot be fearless. The old man says the color of the heart is yellow. He says he is just like a Buddhist monk. He does not worry about death, hence he is fearless. The Duke sent someone to fetch it. It turned out to be a stallion in black. The Duke displeased, summoned Polo. He is no good, the fellow you sent to find me horses. He cannot even tell one color from another, or a mare from a stallion. What can he know about horses? Polo breathed a sigh of wonder. So now he has risen to this. This is the beauty of Tao. They are absurd people, very paradoxical people. But if you start loving them, you will know they have a certain quality which is missing everywhere else. Polo breathed a sigh of wonder. He could not believe it is incredible, because this means the ultimate in Tao. So now he has risen to this, that he cannot even make a judgment whether the horse is a mare or a stallion. So he has reached to the deepest core, because these distinctions are only on the surface. Are you a man or a woman in your deepest being? If I see you as a man, then I don't see you. If I see you as a woman, then I don't see you. The day I see you neither as man nor woman, but see you as your innermost quality reveals to me, then I see you. So he has risen to this now. It is just this that shows that he is worth 1,000, 10,000, any number of people like me. Because now it is a qualitative jump. No quantity can be compared. He is worth 1,000, 10,000, any number of people like me. First, this old man has said that he is equal to me, but now he says, I am nothing. I am just zero compared to him. So he has risen to this insight that he cannot see that the horse is black and sees the yellowness of the horse and cannot see that the horse is a stallion and sees the hidden mare in it, has become able to see the bodiless qualities, the spiritual qualities. Now he is incomparable. What such a man as a cow observes is the innermost native impulse behind the horse movements. Body is just a surface, a moving surface. Just as you go and watch a lake and ripples are on the surface. Those ripples are not the real lake. To know the real lake, you will have to dive deep. The body is just a surface, moving, changing. You have to look into the innermost core, into the unchanging, the constant, the unmoving, because that is what truth is. What such a man as a cow observes is the innermost native impulse behind the harsh movements. He grasps the essence and forgets the dross. Goes right inside it and forgets the outside. He looks far and sees what he needs to see. Ignores what he does not need to see. In the judgment of horses of a man like cow, there is something more important than horses. So he is not just a man who knows horses. No, he knows something more. He knows real Tao. He has the insight to see the whole and not to be worried about the parts. He can see the gestalt, the very pattern, the inmost pattern of the heart. Now he is not worried about the body, the color, male, female, height. He is not worried at all. These are accidental things, non-essential. He looks only for that which is essential, because only essential is meaningful. The meaning comes from the essential. But we always go on looking for the accidental. You see a very rich man, you say, how rich he is. How can a person be rich by just having money? You cannot be rich by just having money. If that is how a man is rich, then Buddha is not rich. And if Buddha is not rich, then who is rich? Alexander is rich. Alexander is a poor man, a beggar. Hence, in the East, we have worshipped beggars and forgotten about emperors. We have not cared much about the emperors. They come and go. That is the surface of existence, non-essential. Have you come to know that in the East we have not written history at all? The West is very much surprised that in the East people have not written history, and history is so important. No, we don't write history. We started writing only with the impact of the West. We write myth, we write mythology, we write Puranas, beautiful parables. We don't bother about history, because history is concerned with the non-essential. History is concerned with politics, day-to-day events, politicians, generals, wars, famines. History is concerned with the very non-essential, the moving, the flux. Myth, mythology, a Purana is concerned with the essential. So there is a trouble when a Western person, starts reading Ramayana. He becomes worried when Ram was born. When? That is not said at all. We are never bothered about it. What does it matter? Any day will do. Any year will do. That is not essential. But we look into the innermost. We look into the essential quality of Rama. What type of man he is. What greatness he carries in his being. What fragrance. What song is his song. Authentically his. We are not worried about the chronological. We are worried about the spiritual. Time is irrelevant. We look into the timeless. That's why he says, in the judgment of horses of a man like cow, there is something more important than horses. He has become a sage himself. And what he has looked first, he grasps the essence and forgets the dross. Remember it. When you look at a man, or you look at a tree, or you look at a rock, always look for the essence and forget the grass. Grass is not the thing. But in the modern world, we forget the essence and look at the grass. If a man has much money, we look. If he has a big car, we look. If he has a big house, we look. We forget the essentials. We don't look direct into his heart. We don't have the eyes. In fact, we don't believe that he has a heart. We don't believe that man has a soul. Man is just a body, a physical thing. So is everything else. So it is not a wonder that our life has become so dull. It has become a drag. There is no joy, no celebration. How celebration can exist without soul? Celebration arises out of soul, out of the spiritual, out of the essential. Joy arises out of your innermost core, and we have denied that. You don't look into yourself, you don't look into others. Only surfaces meet. In fact, it is not right to say meet. The clash, because there is no dialogue. There is discussion, but there is no dialogue. There is argument, but there is no meeting. There is no love, because love can exist only between two souls. When two essential beings look into each other's essentiality, love arises. When you look through your essential core into the essential core of existence, God arises. Don't ask, where is God? God is a dialogue with existence. God is not a being. God is not a person. When you know how to be in a dialogue with existence, you know what God is. God is the meaning of existence. The meaning that permeates the whole. But it can be known only by moving through the essential. The essential is the door. He looks and grasps the essence and forgets the dross. He looks into the innermost native impulse. He looks into the spontaneity of the heart, not what has been cultivated on him. Not in the character. A man may be a saint or may be a sinner. Don't look into the sainthood of a man, and don't look into the sinnerhood of man. Look into the potentiality of our being, his being. And then you will come to see nobody is a sinner and nobody is a saint. Everybody is a sage. Everybody is divine. Sinners and saints all. Then whatsoever a person is doing is not of much importance. Being is important. What you do is very irrelevant. What you are. Your acts are superficial. your being is fundamental. He looks far and sees what he needs to see. You don't look for that which you need to see. Whatsoever comes across, the objectum, whatsoever comes across, you look. You are not searching. Whatsoever accidentally comes in front of you, you look. You don't go deep. You don't explore any potentiality. You don't dive. You just stand outside. At the most, you are a spectator. But life can be known only through participation. Don't be a spectator. And the whole modern world has become just a spectator. A crowd of lookers on. Somebody dances, you look. What you are doing? How can you look at a dance? Dance has to be felt. Dance has to be danced. Somebody is singing and you look. And you listen. To know the song and the beauty of it, you have to sing. You have to participate. But this calamity has taken epidemic proportions. Everything we go on looking. You rush to the movie. For what? Can't you live a beautiful life? You have to go to see a movie. And people are glued to their chair in front of their TVs. Just looking. Other people living. And they are also not living. They are acting for you. They are acting for you. You are seeing those actors. Nobody is living. The dancer is not a true dancer, a professional. And you are the audience. All false. Surfaces clash. And the essentials are not meeting. Look for the essential. And when you start looking for the essential, you will become a participant. You will know a dance has to be known in only one way, and that is to dance. How can you know what swimming is if you just stand on the bank and you see somebody swimming? You will see the strokes and you will see the man doing something in the water, but how you will know the thrill that is happening to him, the kick that is happening to him, the sensation, the buoyancy, the joy, feeling of the river, flowing with the river, dancing with the river. How you will know it? By standing on the bank. Jump into the river. That is the only way to know life. Jump into the river. Never be a spectator. The spectator is the poorest man in the world. Participate. Through participation comes love. Through participation comes truth. Through participation comes beauty. Through participation ultimately comes God. In the judgment of horses of a man like cow, there is something more important than horses. Yes, in this parable, horses are not discussed about. Horses are just an excuse to talk about something tremendously important, significant. When the horse arrived, it did prove to be a great horse. You can also become great horses. And you can also become knowers of great horses. But remember, this parable is not about horses. Horses are just an excuse. The parable is about the sage, the Taoist sage, the great sage. Meditate over on it. Let it sink deep in you. It will give you many insights. Many more than I have talked about. Many more because there are many which cannot be talked about at all. They will be revealed only when you meditate on it. Many more, because when you will meditate certainly in a different way, from your angle, from your vision. I have just given you few indications. These are not fixed rules. I am not an interpreter. Remember always, I am not an interpreter. I love these stories. And I try to share my love with you. It is not an interpretation. I am not a commentator. Commentary is an ugly job. Why should I comment? I am not commenting. I love these stories. I feel the fragrance of these stories. And I like to share that fragrance with you. Maybe through that fragrance you also become interested. Maybe listening to me, a great desire in you arises to go deeper into the waters. If that is done, then my effort has been fruitful. So don't take my interpretations as rigid interpretations, and don't think that I have done the job for you. I cannot chew for you. You will have to chew for yourself. I can simply seduce you. These are seductions, not commentaries. Just seductions, so you become interested in a different dimension. And each Taoist parable opens a diamond, opens a new door. If you go into it, more doors will open. If you go into them, more and more doors will open. It is a non-ending mystery. Enough for today.